Didn't anybody tell you?
Oh my goodness, that's great. It's the music of the Flirtations. Their new album still sounds like the Flirtations. And the album is all the information is posted on our website on the playlist, wamc.org/roundtable. Great music to bring us into our breaks throughout the roundtable. I was busy during the Billboard talking about Mike Bowen, our engineer, who was able to pick up one of our hosts like it was a box of Cheerios, and but noticed with the other two, David and I, that he never has tried to pick us up, and and that's fine, by the way. But I neglected to tell you what was actually on the show. So we have Robert Gassendi, the ambassador who served as a diplomat in the U.S. Foreign Service from the 60s to the 90s, talking to Jim Ketterer. This is part 5 of 6. If you've missed any of those parts, they're all online. It's a fascinating series by a man who has seen a lot and tells these amazing stories. And so we're very lucky to have had Jim interview Bob, and you can get to hear that this morning. Also, we're going to talk to Lucy Antec Johnson. Her father worked with Toscanini, and her father was very much, I think, you know, just what's the word I'm looking for? Greatly influenced by Toscanini. So she has written a book called This Was Toscanini, and we'll talk to her this morning, and then Sarah will talk to a trio of playwrights who are responsible for this year's season at Hudson Valley Shakespeare. So all kinds of good stuff coming up on the program following the panel. And we have a wonderful group of panelists this morning. Let me introduce them to you, and we will get started. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning. It's a reasonably beautiful day, right? Not too hot, so what's not to like?
Yeah, it's a nice day, and we'll take it. Good to see you as always. Dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland Security, and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin. We call him Bob. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Joe. Glad to be here today. So, you know, I usually talk about what national holiday, you know, national recognition days, but there's a serious one today. It's the National Navajo Code Talkers Day. And, you know, for those of you that don't know the history, to take a little bit of time to realize what the Navajo Code Talkers did during World War II. It's an incredibly interesting story, but it's also a lesson about humility and bravery at a time when, you know, there's lots of questions about what service means. So today is one of those serious days.
Well, thank you for bringing it to
our
attention.
And we actually learn about that in school in Germany, because it's such an interesting story, because the German military under the Nazis clearly was trying to figure out what was going on with that language or the code, and they could never crack it because obviously they didn't know anything about an indigenous Native American language. Yeah. And so, yeah, I learned that in high school about the code talkers in Germany.
Yeah, so did we.
No. Oh. No.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to get you on 5 there, Sarah.
There we go.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. Good. All right. We'll fix that. We'll fix that during the break. Albany Law School professor and director of what are you director of?
The Edward P. Swire Justice Center.
The Justice Center. That's great. Congratulations. Were you doing that? And it was the immigration law clinic, and you were doing both?
Yeah, I was doing both, and now I'm still directing the Justice Center, which houses all of our field placements and in-house clinics and what you would think of as experiential learning, clinical learning. But I'm also now directing all of our externship programs.
Oh, that's fantastic.
It's so great.
Oh, yeah. They're really excellent. Well, thank you very much for being here. As always, it's wonderful to have you all. we're in good hands, folks. We have very smart people to talk about the issues of the day. And we're going to begin by talking about election interference. We touched on the story yesterday. Well, we talked quite a bit about it yesterday, but I would like to, we know a little bit more. The suspected Iranian hack. Oh, hold on. They want me to buy shoes. One second.
Those damn Iranians.
I'm a subscriber, damn it. They still have to.
You would think if the hackers are on task,
right,
they'd sell you Iranian hazelnuts or something, you know?
I can guarantee you they don't have them in a size 15. Anyway.
Somewhere outside of Turin, there's somebody going, damn it, those shoes are up again.
As recently as last month, U.S. intelligence officials warned that Iran aimed to stoke societal discord and undermine former President Donald Trump's bid to regain the White House, reprise of its online interference 4 years ago. Now, the 2024 effort appears to have begun with suspected hacking attempts targeting the Republican and Democratic presidential campaigns. Intelligence officials, however, and disinformation experts remain unsure of the precise plan by Iran. The FBI is investigating suspected hacking by Iran targeting Trump associate Roger Stone, as well as advisors to the Biden-Harris campaign that use spear phishing emails, attempts to gain access to a target's communications by posing as a legitimate sender. That could have given intruders access to a vetting document prepared for the campaign on Senator J.D. Vance, Trump's running mate, that was sent to news organizations by an individual identifying himself only as Robert Bob.
So I have a theory about the name, Joe, is that if you look at the cryptology, and if you look at the issue of Bitcoin, the Dread Pirate Roberts is a name that has been used in sort of the black hat community. So I actually think the use of the name Robert is a tip to that. So anybody who hasn't read the Andy Greenberg books on Sandworm or any cyber, it's an interesting choice of names.
In an email with a Washington Post reporter, that person suggested his access to Trump campaign documents was distinct from the Iranian hacking effort. Federal law enforcement officials are trying to determine if the two events are connected. Well, that just muddies the waters, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's some irony here, too. So let's talk irony for a second. One, the very FBI that Trump wants to defund is, you know, in charge of the investigation. Also, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't start this with a recollection about what happened in 2016, where Trump used the hacking of the Clinton campaign as a sign of organizational incompetence that made her unfit to be president. In fact, there's a situation where he actually called on Russia to hack the account. So there's a really interesting sort of background history here. One of the things that I will push back politely, these attacks though occurred on both political parties. The effort, I believe, from Tehran is to continue to undermine the people's confidence in our systems. I know right now this is being sort of portrayed as sort of Trump against the world and another example of his victimhood, but it's not. This was on both parties. It's also somewhat karma-ish that Roger Stone, of all people, was the person involved in it. I thought we had his stench out of American politics, but apparently he's still involved.
The U.S. officials warning that Iran was aiming to stoke societal discord. How can you tell? I mean, it just seems like we've been in societal discord for quite a while.
It doesn't take much.
No, right. Yeah, it's like how much do you have to add to that?
But that's an important point, though. But if it's, you know, because the flame is so hot right now, it only takes a little more accelerant to again fan the flames. And this will be used as part of the grievance when he loses the election. It will be because of the outside interference. It will be because of the he'll at some point say that Harris is probably some sort of Iranian double agent. Or I mean, this is the stuff that he will pull out, and his true believers will believe it.
The interesting thing is, you know, that it was identified as an Iranian hacker right away, when I thought it's also possible it's Russians, it's also possible it's North Korean. I'm sort of, you know, curious about that. We don't know any details. There has been just a mention of it's suspected to be Iranian. I don't know. I'm curious. I would like to know a little bit more about the backstory, and maybe we will hear about it. But it certainly is possible to have multiple countries involved in that and at the same time. And I think we have to just get used to the fact that certain regimes would like to really mess with Americans' beliefs in our system, as you said, Bob. I think this is the main idea. What they're doing in those countries, they have teams that permanently watch U.S. television stations, and based on the reporting and whatever journalists highlight, they interpret social conditions. So sometimes they're good at it and it works out, and sometimes they're overreaching. And in this case, they seem to have overreached because they have not actually all that much new information. They're recycling some of the information that was in the public sphere already. And I'm actually very happy that no journalists have disclosed the dossier or the information that was sent, because it just would have created sort of this other sort of cycle of negative responses. So number one, I'm not sure if it's only Iran. I think there are multiple potential actors, and I'd like to have more information about what, if it was Iran, what their actual plan is. Because creating chaos may be somewhat helpful, but, you know, I'm not sure if the Iranians really have clarity here in terms of why they go for certain interferences.
Sarah? Everyone should be locking down their cyber presence. This is the one we know about mm-hmm. today.
Yep.
Leading up to November, there will be more mm-hmm. from all external and internal actors within the country. I mean, we have some of the most sophisticated cyber criminals right here in the good old US of A. So it's time to start locking down everything in a much more responsible way.
Yeah, and your point about the Russian interference is really interesting, and there is a lot of intel that points to nexus of cooperation between the GRU, the Russian mm-hmm. Secret Service. Russia has also turned hacking over to their own organized crime units, which have this sort of weird governmental mm-hmm. independent relationship. You get North Korea, and you start to think about this, the axis of funding of weaponry into uh-huh. Ukraine with Russia yep. and Iran and China and North Korea. You see it coming together. Now, the cynical side of me says that they purposely didn't call out Russian interference mm-hmm. in part because I think that if you look at where money is flowing into campaigns, yep. that there is more support for a Trump campaign from Russia than there would be for right. Harris. Mm-hmm. The other cynical part of me, though, Joe, says that given the fact that the war drums are beating really loudly in the Middle East right now, with, you know, sort of waiting with bated breath for some sort of attack from Iran on Israel, that this, right. that this is also sort of almost an Orwellian prelude to setting up anger in the United States at Iran for interfering yeah. into politics. So there's sort of a multidimensional elements of this that I'm kind of playing with.
So you mentioned something that I also thought about, very interesting, sort of because the Russians get drones from Iran. And maybe there's some kind of a deal, drones for hacking support. I mean, there are all kinds of things that are happening all the time between those countries because they are increasingly economically marginalized. At least, you know, the populations are suffering tremendously, while not the elites. But, I mean, there is a potential both in Iran and in Russia for some regional unrest again.
Well, and if you think there isn't a direct, I'm in a PSA kind of mood, but if you don't think that there's a link between your social media consumption and your news consumption and what is tracked on your computer through your IP uh-huh. address and your browser history and what's happening in this big story that seems immense and sort of something that an individual might feel detached from, mm-hmm. it's directly related. Mm-hmm. Every single thing that you do online on a computer, whether it's work or personal or a combination of both, which is messy, is feeding into this system. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just a reminder to pay attention to where you're getting your news from. And Facebook is not the best place for that.
Or social media in general,
period.
I think.
We'll take a break and pause there. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. We welcome your letters on this Wednesday morning, panel@wamc.org. And we'll return after this break in news from the BBC.
For the ride, don't give in, lose or win. What goes up?
Not only does Mike Bowen press all the buttons and make sure that we all sound good and that you can actually hear us, but he bench presses employees. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
pretty cool. Good morning, all. Welcome to the program. We have a great group this morning. Vera Karius-Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Sarah Rogerson. And we welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Bob, I had read a piece maybe a day and a half ago, so I don't know how relevant it is now. But my understanding was initially, at least on part of the hacking, which may not have been the Iranian part, but as far as the some of the spear phishing that was done, that seemed to affect the Trump campaign more because they actually opened the emails versus the Harris campaign that seemed to be
slow in opening emails.
Did not open the emails. Right.
Yes.
Identified them, put them aside, and said these are things that we don't want to open.
Yeah. And you know, this is a message to my provost too. Like those emails that I haven't opened from you, it's just because I'm concerned about spear phishing.
Oh, absolutely. 100%.
No. I think that's it. I think that's exactly right. And you know, back to Sarah's point about you know just good cyber hygiene. You have to really pay attention, and it's hard because I've had issues where I've been spearfished, and I mean it was just for dumb luck that I didn't contaminate the systems.
So for people who do not know, explain what spearfishing is.
So basically, what it is that a hacker will take over an identity of someone who is known to you. And then send a link and embed it in an email to you, and you open it up thinking, oh hey Vera, I haven't heard from her. How's she doing? You know, and I open it up and all of a sudden I realize it's not Vera at all, and that there is now a virus that's in the system that is opening up my emails and my system's emails to the hacker's control. It's not the, you know, I'm not making fun of people who fell under the Nigerian prince scam or the scams,
right.
which was sort of a more of a blast a spam attempt. The spear phishing is really sophisticated. And it's, you actually have to go in and look specifically at the address that's underneath the name that's showing in the email to see. So in a situation where I get something from you, Joe, that says, you know, it's, you know, your email at WAMC.org or whatever the email address is, I have to click on that to make sure that's what it says underneath. Because if it says, you know, Joey Gubu from Gmail underneath it, it means mm-hmm. that didn't come from you.
Right.
Yeah. So I've actually been spearfished on Facebook Messenger where I hadn't been in touch with somebody for a long time, and it was somebody who was like an older colleague of mine who retired 10 years ago, and all of a sudden I got a message, and I thought, oh my gosh, I haven't heard from you in so long, and I did a response, and then I was thinking after a couple of exchanges, I was like, well, that's a strange conversation. That doesn't really sound like the person I know. And then I just discontinued, you know, but it's scary when you're thinking, oh my God, it took like 2 or 3 little exchanges before you actually realized this was not the person you thought it was.
So we have this letter from John who says, it seems to me that if the best the hacker could come up with is J.D. Vance's vetting process, then they failed miserably. Why bother releasing that? Well, we don't really know, do we?
No, we don't know what they have. We don't know what they have released or not released. I think, you know, yesterday I was complimenting Joe on yesterday's panel. I thought it was a really interesting conversation. Mm-hmm. You could see some divergence among the roundtable members yesterday. Mm-hmm. But the idea of the press's responsibility and what does a responsible journalist do or release with information? And I think this is a struggle that we're seeing from places like Politico and New York Times and Washington Post. And despite of all the slings and arrows against the mainstream media, I think the mainstream media has actually gone out of its way to not elevate the illegitimately gained information. Mm-hmm. Which becomes sort of a real question, right? Mm-hmm. of ethics.
So the only information that we know has been disclosed is because some of the media have talked about what was sent by Robert, right? This
right.
Robert guy, or person, or identity, and there might be a whole host of other bits of information they've collected and released to people that we haven't heard from, that are thinking about how to use it. I mean, there's a lot of sort of obscured bits of details that we have no idea about.
In the Washington Post, there's an article about this, and for some reason, someday I'll understand why it's in the style section. But true. An alleged Iranian hacking operation. They say so far newsrooms have been reluctant to run with the material. Over the past few weeks, reporters at Politico, The Washington Post, and The New York Times received emails from a mysterious figure offering internal Trump campaign documents, most notably a 271-page listing J.D. Vance's potential vulnerabilities as a running mate. The FBI is now investigating, but that question of newsrooms being reluctant to run with it, and I guess if it's obvious that you don't, and we did discuss this yesterday with Judy and Terry Gibson, as well as Mark Whitman, that the question is, okay, so you have a pseudonym offering internal documents of questionable news value. What do you do with that? And I think the answer is, like, you wait, right? You turn over to the FBI and see what happens.
The cynical side of me says that anything that hackers could have about J.D. Vance's idiosyncrasies and weaknesses have been on stunning full display ever since he was nominated. I mean, he has no problem getting up there a la natural, showing everybody why he is incompetent. You know, he has to be considered one of the worst initial choices for vice presidential candidate since Palin. I mean, although he's making Palin, you know, Sarah Palin look very, very smart right
Poised.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's also, you know, the hackers may have thought they had something special, you know, showing all of the deficiencies of J.D. Vance until he got up and mm-hmm. started to open his mouth.
Or I'm sort of, you know, let's think about this. I think there's a possibility that Trump will dump Vance as the VP and there might be something to that idea and create, you know, get somebody new. I mean, it's possible, right?
I thought that we were at the point that they were locked in with him because of ballots have already started to.
Are they beginning to print ballots now?
Is it over?
Okay.
I thought so.
So.
And I mean, that would have then Trump would have to admit that he doesn't hire and promote the best people.
It was advised to him. You know, he didn't really. You know, it doesn't matter what. You know, he just insists and then it happens.
Well, I don't even think it matters what what people's what information surfaces about J.D. Vance to the people who are dead set on voting in favor of the Trump Vance ticket. I don't think it matters. I'm not. I mean, Trump has been convicted of crimes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That were surfacing during the last election, and his supporters don't care. So, well, you know, I don't know if there needs to be some more clever. Well, his most ardent supporters don't care.
I would agree with that because I was thinking, you know, the labor unions are working the case real hard because they had some, you know, obviously, you know, members of the labor unions that began to support Trump, and they, I think they're peeling them off now.
So here's Steve's thoughts on this. He says, I have doubts that the Trump campaign was actually hacked. Trump needs to be at the top of the news cycle. He needs his supporters to think Iran and Russia are afraid of him. A non-hurtful, quotes, end quotes, a non-hurtful document was released. Show us something meaningful. Sounds like malarkey, says Steve.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and I mean, every speech that I've heard, including that really horrible discussion on X's after they finally got it running, is just a litany of complaints and whining and victimhood from Trump. I do think this was real. I do think it affected both campaigns. I do think that. It was probably an element both of skill, luck, and experience. Remember, the Democrats got, you know, it affected the 2016 mm-hmm. campaign when they got hacked and their documentation was released. So I think, you know, they hopefully had learned from that experience. Mm-hmm.
We will take a break. When we come back, we'll move on to other subjects. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Yes, I do, do, do. There ain't no easy way to say that I miss you, babe.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Wednesday, the 14th of August. Vera Karius-Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Sarah Rogerson make up our group, and very lucky to have them, very lucky to have you, and you can join us at panel at WAMC.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind in regards to these particular issues. Matthew says, in regard to the potential hacking of Trump's campaign website by Iranian agents, I have two thoughts. First, it is clear that almost every time a hostile nation interferes in our elections, they do so in order to benefit Trump's efforts to regain the White House. That should tell all of us that our enemies would by far prefer a chaos agent like Donald Trump in charge of America, putting to lie the Trumpian narrative of what a strong leader he is on the world stage. Two, until an outside source confirms that Trump's campaign website was actually hacked by outsiders, this seems like just another typical example of Trump setting up the fraudulent election trope. Well, both campaigns are saying they were hacked.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. The attempt was made, and the FBI are investigating it. I also will say that I think the Iranians do hold a special grudge at Trump, particularly for the assassination of their General Soleimani. The other element that I'll toss on the table and turn it over to the other panelists is don't forget, everybody at home, that Iran has their president was killed in a helicopter accident. They have an almost brand new president who is finding. You know, still trying to get his feet under him at a time when there's still unrest within the country, now facing an external war with Iran and poking at the United States. So there's a lot of pieces at play with this whole Iranian story.
Go ahead.
Although the Iranian president comes from the new one after the helicopter crash of the prior one, comes from within the system. So he brings his own connections up and his military revolutionary guard support. So he's not an unknown quantity in the country, but there may be some, you know, removal of old loyalists with the new loyalists, and clearly the new president is quite unpopular with the population.
Bob writes and says, why talk about election interference like this is a new phenomena? The Clinton campaign bought Russian information against Trump in 2016. As Mark Whitman mentioned a few days ago, this is as old as the birth of this nation. That was yesterday, actually. Yawn, find another boogeyman for the elections. Keep it domestic, such as the Democratic Party throwing out the democratically elected President Biden because he looked bad in one debate. Nothing more authoritarian and fascist than a party throwing out a democratically elected representative to appease the corporate and billionaire class who donate to the party.
So as somebody who comes from a country that actually has a fascist regime, I would caution you to use that name in that connection, because clearly you have no idea what a fascist regime looks like.
Also, Biden is still president of the United States of America. So, you know, the nomination of a different candidate is very different than, say, what was attempted on January 6th.
No one is going to take over. Right. I mean, it wasn't there. No, in theory, no one will take over if they weren't elected to the office. Kamala Harris will not become the president prior to an election.
Correct. Yes. She is still the vice president of the United
Correct.
States.
Yes.
And respectfully, you know, I know what you're trying to do with the email, and you know, you're trying to deflect, and I get it. I don't know if it checks one of your troll boxes today or not, but. This is also an opportunity just for everybody at home to realize that hacking, while we're talking about it occurring to two major parties who are really well-funded and should have some of the best cybersecurity in the world, it happens. This is also an opportunity to steal, Sarah, your term of, you know, a PSA. It's something we all have got to be aware of. And it's really easy to forget that. You know, life goes on and you get busy and you don't check, you know, what you're doing online. And it can just have enormous impacts on your own personal family. So it's an opportunity to remind folks to watch where they are, especially watch what your kids are doing on social media. You know, I can't say stay off it because that's just not realistic. But at the same time, be very, very vigilant.
Let's go to this letter from James. Do we really need to worry about foreign actors hacking the Trump campaign? Come on. Really, people? Really? Worrying about this is like worrying about the mafia getting hacked. Boo-hoo, boo-hoo.
There's another deep cynicism in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Again, it's not just the Trump campaign getting hacked.
No.
And the principle is hacking is not helpful to the democratic process, because the intent of it is to disclose information or use information to weaken some group or public trust in systems. And that is what the Russians did throughout Europe in the past decades, intensively in the last 10 years. And, you know, it's very unhelpful when people rely on information that is incorrect, and then a lack of belief in your own system and the constant sort of sense that nobody is up to anything helpful, your local government is out there to hurt you. And those kinds of sentiments are reflected as in part because of misinformation and hacking campaigns. So overall, it is anti-democratic in principle. So even if it affects somebody who you don't support, it is negative for the country overall and the common good.
Yeah, really, that's the most important part of this story, is that this is an effort from an adversarial foreign government to chip away at the most foundational elements of our country. It doesn't, in my mind, it's not Trump or the it's not the GOP or the Democrats. This is another effort to make us question the most basic assumptions about the elements of this country and what it means and what our institutions mean. And that's what it is. I mean, this is a digital attack on the very fiber of the country. That's why we're talking about it.
So add to that a presidential candidate who is saying that picture you saw at the airport of 15,000 people greeting Kamala Harris was AI generated, and there was no one at that airport.
Yeah, and this is a guy who says, despite what you saw on January 6th, that was a perfect peaceful demonstration, with the exception of the Antifa involved. I mean, despite the fact that we watched his people march up, attack police.
Live on television.
Live on television, mm-hmm. He has sold this narrative to a remarkably large population of the United States that this is peaceful, and these poor people who were convicted are somehow political prisoners.
And it was a crowd larger than MLK's "I Have a Dream" speech.
The number of lies the guy tells. I mean, we all know it's just
staggering.
Staggering. Thank you.
I mean, you know, one lacks the words to describe this.
But I just want to link the two together. I mean, you have this hacking of trying to sow unrest within the political system. But we, you know, then we have candidates doing that as well.
We do. But then this becomes the excuse when Trump loses. It becomes the excuse. It becomes it was stolen from me. This is because of foreign interference. You never hear him say, "Wow, I'm a terrible businessman. I have no message. I had no platform. I'm such an obnoxious boob that I turned, you know, the vast majority of the country off."
Nice catch there.
He never takes. It was a big gulp there. So, sorry, they were hovering over the button. He never takes responsibility. So this becomes part of the narrative again about how poor Donald Trump is a victim. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the whole MAGA narrative right now. It's all about this idea of victimhood.
It's part of the long game of gaining power by any means necessary. It's planting seeds in the inevitable, hopefully, eventuality that they'll lose and have to do something about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you
and it's a, there's a patriotic ahead. Responsibility because this is coming from an adversary like Iran.
Yeah, he's speaking directly to nefarious groups like Proud Boys, Michigan Militia, Sovereign Citizens. He's building his own army through this corrupted political rhetoric, and it's going to take a long time for political rhetoric in the country to recover from this, like decades, like after I'm dead.
You know, I was thinking about this the other day, not you dying, but about
R.I.P.
About how long it would take for us to turn to some semblance of normalcy. And I don't know what that is. I mean, I don't even know what normal is anymore. But, you know, I was talking yesterday. We were mentioning on the show about there was the push to have Kamala Harris do interviews and a press conference and so forth. And to me, there is like that old school thought of, oh, well, that's what you do as a candidate. You know, that's what we would expect. And then I thought of all of those things that we expect that are just right out the window now. We don't do any of it anymore. And I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a better way of doing it. Not sure, but how do we come to at least it being fair and establishing, wait for it, trust?
So can I make a comment quickly?
Yes.
We can watch what's happening in the UK with the campaign to mislead the general public on Brexit, on healthcare access, the immigration debate, and it took 10 years for the Labour Party to come back and begin to sort of, you know, talk about other agenda items. And yet at the same time, we had the hard right trying to stir up anti-immigrant riots and violence. And they tried it in Birmingham. They tried
in
Liverpool.
Kingdom.
What's that?
In the United Kingdom.
In the UK. Yes, yeah. In the UK. And when you think about that, you know, the local populations went out and confronted the rioters and tried to push back. And that took 10 to 12 years for people to begin to say, you know, that is not the conduct and that is not the kind of thought process that we want in the UK. And the hard right there is deeply influential in trying to actually remove the recently elected prime minister of the UK.
We have to take a break, but we'll be back. We'll continue our conversation. We'll move on to other topics. Ray Graff with news is first, and then we'll return.
So are you ready for love? Do you want to share your feelings? Don't pretend. Let me know. I need someone to believe in.
It's the Flirtations, and their new album is Still Sounds Like the Flirtations, and you can see the playlist posted online at wamc.org/roundtable. wamc.org/roundtable. Panel at wamc.org if you'd like to get in and comment on what you're hearing and either have a comment or a question for our panelists. Ken wrote in, said, "It is darkly humorous to hear you bemoan online misinformation election meddling from other governments in light of the U.S. government's instigation and support of 80-plus actual coups against duly elected foreign governments, including in Ukraine in 2014, all with disastrous results."
Yes. I mean, we're the most powerful country in the world, which we still are, and the most stable country in the world, which we still are. It's part of, we have a moral imperative to do as much good as we can in the world, and sometimes that involves doing things that are objectively not right. It's like the, you know, it's just it's the tension of being of having that much power. With great power comes great responsibility.
Right. Yeah. Anybody else want to jump in on that? Okay.
I'm not condoning it.
No. No.
Okay.
Thank you.
Well, you know, we teach about it in our classes, Latin America, Middle East, Africa. There have been lots of coups. Yeah, there have been lots, you know, I mean, I talk about it all the time in terms of, you know, coup attempts. It's a, you know, the kind of media intervention is different today, qualitatively different from coups in the past, because there were often direct, you know, military interventions, people sent, people financially supported, as is ongoing. But we're talking right now about hacking and reaching the general population in terms of misleading them and making them not trust their own government. You know, this is kind of newer. It's different from what's happened in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, I think.
Ricky writes, "President Trump can claim that he is a victim of Iranian hacking, but in reality his campaign has weak, inadequate cybersecurity, and his being hacked is his own fault. If they are elected, that will make America's cybersecurity weak and ineffective."
Yeah, Consumer Reports has a great workbook if you want to explore where you're vulnerable in your own cybersecurity. And the reason why I know is because I have sensitive information about myself on the dark web. So,
oh,
not sure how that happened, but
oh, that's not good.
And how? Well, try to keep that from happening again.
But how did you find out about that?
Because I have multiple layers of alert systems that let me know because I'm paranoid.
Smart.
Wow.
Russ says, "Please, folks, it's not the astounding number of lies that Donald Trump has told. It's his pattern, his way of being. Unfortunately, that is not what is being said by the national media. And it really needs to be. He lies. He says crap. He lies. He says crap. He lies. Dot, dot, dot. He doesn't just say these things. He is, without question, completely full of it. Most of his supporters will never either recognize or care about this, but for everybody else's sake, that is what needs to be said. The man is just and only full of it.
But I mean, we're talking about a race right now that is within 2 or 3 percentage points.
Basically, a dead heat.
Where a huge swath of this country thinks that all of the issues that you just legitimately raised are unimportant. And I think part of the responsibility of the panel is to sort of ask the question, like, why is that? Yeah. And what does that say about the country, and what does it say about our future?
Yeah. And I think in part the reason for that is that we are so wrapped up in populist kind of politics in this country now, instead of having actual policy debates, because policies are complicated and people don't always have an interest or attention span to sort of think about the finer details of policies, and it's very complicated. I mean, that's in essence, if all of us wanted to know about all the policies and the potential impacts, it'd be impossible to do as a voter. It's just too much. So we rely on representatives to interpret those policies, but over time, we've become less interested in actual policies that impact people's lives directly, and we've become more interested in public performances. Speech patterns, behavior, shouting, entertainment. It's political art and performance that we have become used to in this country rather than policy debates. And that is also one of those fundamental, scary developments here, anti-democratic. When you become interested in populist entertainment and politics as theater, you're in trouble.
Jonathan writes and says, could Vera elaborate on her statement that the hard right in Britain is influential, maybe very influential, in working to get rid of Prime Minister Starmer?
Mm-hmm.
What are they doing? Do they have influential members of parliament working on this?
So what is known so far is that domestic intelligence services are researching the use of their social media to stir up violence against particular groups. So what they're trying to do is, I'm not sure if they have a strong support within Parliament, but what they do have is extensive access to X, for example, which is hard to control for the British government, even though they want to curtail it once again. But the police is asking for serious controls over social media, because they're using it effectively to reach out to people who feel economically marginalized, to stir up public violence by targeting immigrants or minority communities or people that can be otherwise publicly identified and marginalized. So this is a very nasty pattern. It's Charlottesville in the UK.
So Nigel Farage, right, is far right. And one of the things about the election in the UK that's really important to remember is that while the Conservatives lost, Labour gained, but the far right also gained.
They also gained, yeah.
And there are a couple of elements that I would toss back to the letter writer to think about. Mm. One is that there's a pattern, right? You say the Liberals or Labour Party is weak on crime. You go cause riots and mm-hmm. then question the police response and the government's response to those riots. Then you run against it on a campaign of what? Anti-crime, not mm-hmm. Tough on crime, and then you use this as a way of getting back into office. Mm-hmm. The other thing where I hope both MI5 and MI6, the intelligence, both domestic mm-hmm. and foreign in the UK, are looking at is who is funding these efforts.
Yep.
This isn't just a pop-up effort for a bunch of hooligans
who are grumpy.
I'm sorry?
Who are grumpy.
Who are grumpy, right. No, this is much more sophisticated than that. And mm-hmm. understanding who's funding it, why they're funding it, and how to combat that's critically mm-hmm. important.
British authorities have now arrested more than 1,000 people following mm-hmm. days of rioting involving violence, arson, and looting, as well as racist attacks targeting mm-hmm. Muslims and migrants, mm-hmm. according to a national policing body this morning. Said this. The riots, which followed the killings of three young girls in the northern English town of Southport, began after the July 29th attacks was wrongly blamed on an Islamist migrant based on online misinformation. So I'm not expecting you to explain the motivations behind this, Sarah, but how does something like that gain traction so quickly to such a high level?
Because the seeds were already sown for it long ago, and
right.
really that's happened in the United States.
So, like, the embers are burning
always, yeah. and they get stoked whenever they start to die down. You know, those stories. No matter how this election unfolds in the United States, we can expect that even if the Harris Waltz ticket is successful, that there will be a response that looks similar in terms of unrest, blaming of migrants being the other, which in the United States is, well, and in Europe too, is people who are black and brown, because it's not solely those groups, but that's what's portrayed to divide and to continue to take those embers and whip them up into flames that then distract from the real leadership that the Harris-Waltz administration could be doing, and instead they have to turn their attention mm-hmm. to this distraction.
I was struck, though, by in reading about this, this number of 1,024 mm-hmm. people who were arrested, 575 charged. Many have already been jailed and sentenced to mm-hmm. really long sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And you compare that, and I know it's different, but you compare that to January 6th.
Or George Zimmerman.
Right.
Yep.
Right. And I guess, you know, and I brought up January 6th just because we've heard former President Trump say, well, we'll pardon them all.
Yeah.
And here in the UK, but it is so we have seen sort of a slight dimming because people are actually going to jail. We don't have a system that really mm-hmm. allows for that here, which we could argue is good or bad, but still that's a huge difference.
Yeah, it's always stunning when the Law and Order party gets upset that law and order is actually being applied to them.
Yeah.
That's always my favorite.
Yeah, that's it's a good head scratcher, isn't it? Yeah.
So
sorry, Vera.
Yeah, I was just going to say in the UK they don't have the same protections for freedom of speech.
Yeah.
Which allows the police to crack down on hate speech much more quickly than here. Also, stand your ground laws don't exist. You can't just, you know, so easily access weapons and carry them and use them to defend yourself in the UK or Europe in general. So that's different in terms of context. But also, I wanted to say to Bob, in terms of the funding, which is one of the fundamental issues, we have to think about the hard right, the violent hard right, like we thought about Al Capone. We have to cut them off financially. Because when you think about, do you remember Breivik in Sweden, I think he went into a camp and killed
yes.
all these people a few years ago. He was internationally connected. And then the guy in Christchurch, Australia mm-hmm. was inspired. All these people are in constant contact through the World Wide Web and the dark web, and they exchange information and they try out strategies in different countries and they see how police forces and governments respond. And what we're seeing in the UK is a practice run for what we're going to see here.
Yeah, and the safety plan is, like you said, Vera, people in the UK, good people coming mm-hmm. together to say we're not going to tolerate this behavior yep. in our society. So rather than posting on social media or writing a nasty gram to WAMC, a better use of your time is to actually connect with your neighbors, not online, but in person, to maybe bake a pie, honestly, and take it over or have dinner together. Identify 15 families within walking distance of your home. Start thinking about people that you could join together with to say, this is not permitted in our, in this country that we're building together. That's a better use. That's the safety plan for this next election, no matter who wins the election.
And Joe, one of my, sort of side interests has long been the soccer hooliganism in the UK that we saw in the 70s, 80s, and in part in the 90s. And what the UK had to do to finally break the back of that effort. And if you look at the English Premier League right now, which is probably the richest sports league in the entire world, it was taken out of the ashes of just ridiculous levels of thuggery and street violence that sort of permeated the whole soccer culture. Reason I bring this up is because, in addition to the changes in the issues of the difference of the laws and the King's Law versus mm-hmm. the United States laws, they have a series of capabilities on their books to really stop this and basically throw the book. So when the commissioner comes out, when their police commissioner comes out and says, we're going to be seeking 10-year terms for this, you go out and you riot, we're going to seek a 10-year term, that sends a really, really clear message. But there is a whole history that goes along with this. They also have powers that our police don't have, including use mm-hmm. of CCTV yep. and the ability for the police to go back afterwards and continue to charge.
Yep. And they have the advantage of still collaborating with Interpol in Europe, and they exchange information because people still, even though UK is not part of the European Union anymore, they still exchange security-related information. So that's also a wider net.
The New York Times, just using the first name of this individual, Abdul Moiz, who fled to the UK for safety, then an anti-immigrant mob attacked. Abdul Moiz, an asylum seeker from Sudan, feared for his life when far-right rioters tried to set fire to the hotel where he was housed. The violence has eased, but he is still afraid. He's in his 20s. Said he watched from an upstairs window when other men trapped inside. All they could do was pray and wait, he said, as the men outside began attacking the building, throwing objects, breaking windows, and chanting, "Get them out." Some of the attackers tried to set fire to the building. People were in a panic, he said, who asked to be identified only by his first name to avoid jeopardizing his asylum claim, and who spoke just days after the attack through an interpreter. If the people outside didn't kill us, he feared, the smoke would have. I bring that into the conversation to slightly go to another story that is in the New York Times today about, and just the latest numbers that we have seen, that immigrants are becoming U.S. citizens at the fastest clip in years. So you hear the story of this Syrian man who went to the U.K. for safety, and then you look at immigrants who are coming to this country. I assume for many of the same reasons.
Yes.
Often the same reasons.
Yes.
Safety, security.
Yep.
Stability.
Sure.
And so the government has reduced a backlog of applications that built up during the Trump administration. New citizens say they are looking forward to voting in November. How do we keep that going?
Don't elect Trump again. That's...
Let me put that. Hold on.
Yeah, this is right. Jot that down. Yeah. Because
number one,
really, yeah. they put a screeching halt on all sorts of applications, and they went after kids. We had special immigrant juveniles with cases pending with the government that had already taken, they take like a year and a half to develop, because you have to get an order from a United States family court placing this child who has to have been abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both parents under the statute, and which is an offspring of a number of other legislative initiatives to protect certain particularly vulnerable populations, including victims of human trafficking and survivors of domestic violence. So those kids have to go through a family court proceeding and have somebody designated to be their guardian. And there has to be an order that issues from the family court finding that they satisfy these eligibility requirements. Then you have to file applications with the federal government to say that this child and their guardian also satisfy the requirements, the federal requirements for getting the status that makes you eligible to apply for a green card eventually, which later helps you become a citizen. Okay, that's the population. That's one of the populations that Trump targeted immediately upon taking office, were kids who are abused, abandoned, or neglected by one or both parents who had lawfully appointed guardians in the United States. Imagine what he would do to literally anybody else who tries to come to this country.
Can I flip the story for a second, Joe? The story to me isn't the fact that the Biden administration finally forced the bureaucracy to do what the law says that should be doing.
Well, and fund and staff the agency.
Right. The story is that the Trump DHS through every roadblock,
Department of Homeland Security,
through every roadblock they could in the way of people receiving the legitimate nationalization that they deserved. We're talking about people with green cards. We're talking about people who were married to American citizens for more than 3 years. They purposely necked down the capacity for these legitimate citizens to receive the final step of their citizenship. So that to me is what the story is about. It's not that the Biden administration is doing, you know, oh look, you see they're trying to pack the voter rolls for election, that which was the tone of the story, and I really push back on that. The real story is how the Trump minions abused United States citizenships and laws.
Agreed. 100% agreed. And we can't make predictions about how new citizens will vote, but we do know that immigrants are not a voting bloc one way or the other. It's very complicated. So, yeah, that story sort of perpetuates another myth that new citizens will vote and vote for liberal candidates.
But to see this group, there's a picture that accompanies the article of individuals from 19 different countries who, and it's just a beautiful picture of people from all walks of life who are in this country and are now citizens
and
of the
doing
United States.
It the right way, quote unquote.
That whatever, yes, yeah. Right. But and you think the hell that they've been through to get from step one to having a small American flag in their hands and saying you're a U.S. citizen.
Yeah, one of the first clients that we represented when I founded the Immigration Law Clinic, I guess it's 9 years ago, we're in our 10th year at Albany Law School, was just naturalized, like this summer.
Wow. Well, that puts it in perspective.
That's not unusual. That's pretty quick for a lot of people.
And you know, the assumption this article makes that all immigrants, especially brown and black people, vote the same way is so profoundly offensive, because we know the various divisions within Latin Americans and their agenda interests, and you know, it is so wrong to assume they're all going to vote Democratic, because we know a lot of Muslims have particular issues with the Biden administration on Palestine, on Afghanistan, and so on.
Stop you there. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Vera Carius-Kelly, Bob Griffin, and Sarah Rogerson. And we just have a few moments before we wrap up on this Wednesday edition. So let's see. Another story or two. We'll see what kind of trouble we can get into over on that.
Hey, Joe, why are you looking? I just want to note that the inflation was 2.9%. So it looks like there's going to be I would think there's a rate drop coming in September. Shows you strength of the economy. So
announced this morning.
Hot off the press.
I want to real quick go to just a political story, but. The Democratic nominee for vice president held his first solo event yesterday and defended his military record in a speech at a labor event. Tim Walz said, "To anyone brave enough to put on that uniform for our great country, including my opponent, I just have a few simple words. Thank you for your service and sacrificed. He pushed back on GOP attacks on his military service and the timing of his departure from the Army National Guard during his first solo campaign appearance, just a week after. It's only been a week. His first solo campaign appearance a week after being named Vice President Kamala Harris's running mate. During a speech Tuesday before one of the nation's largest public sector unions, the longtime National Guard member took a moment to address recent scrutiny of his military record by former President Trump and his allies, including his running mate, Senator J.D. Vance of Ohio. I firmly believe you should never denigrate another person's service record, Walz said at the convention of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And I will say from the veterans in my life, that's the one thing that they are most upset about is that you have a veteran denigrating someone else's service. But anyway, to anyone brave enough to put on that uniform for our great country, including my opponent, I just have a few simple words. Thank you for your service and sacrifice.
So I watched the speech. So I admit that I am warming to Walz. He was not my first choice. What I really like about him is he is extremely genuine. I appreciate the fact that he continues to be a gentle person, even when something this basic is, you know, something like his service is being attacked, you know, and at a more fundamental level, Joe, let me ask you this question. You know, they're saying, wow, you know, you only served 24 years. And my question with Vance is, why didn't you serve another 20 then? And then my real question is with Trump is, if you want to make a comparison, you know, let's open up the records and find out about those bone spurs of yours that deferred you from Vietnam. I mean, if you look at the attacks on Walz right now, there's a feeling like they're desperately trying to grasp at something to try to derail the growing enthusiasm, and you see it at the rallies, but you also are seeing it with the polls, and you know we see what the next round of attack is going to be about, how Minnesota handled riots. You know, they're just thrashing around.
So when you think about the Trump administration having called John McCain a loser, when he was a prisoner of war and was tortured horrifically, and you know that alone, I mean, I was never politically supportive of John McCain, but to attack somebody who was tortured like that, I mean, you have no shame. You have no understanding of what it means to be in service of your country. You have no idea what it took to survive that. And, you know, that repulses me. And I see the same pattern continue in these attacks against Walz because, you know, he did 24 years of service, and then he continued as a public servant in a political role. Really, how many of those people do we have around that are trustworthy and thoughtful and empathetic?
And going back to John Kerry and the Swift voting.
Yeah.
But the Dems are really smart this time around. They're flipping the script in the same breath. Walz is talking about him being the only union member candidate since Ronald Reagan, and saying, you know, Donald Trump wouldn't know how to use a McFlurry machine, which is actually a deep cut because of how much Donald Trump loves McDonald's.
Well, it's also, but it's a deeper cut too because it's a single button to push to turn the machine on. That's just want to know.
Yeah,
that.
Yeah. That's good stuff. I assume this will continue, and as far as it's a strategy and it's something that will continue, it seems like it's been answered, but I don't know.
Well, I think it's going to continue, and you know, it is unfortunately part of American politics. I'll go back to the comment I made earlier, how genuine he is, and you know, the fact that he isn't a tech millionaire or a multimillionaire. I think one of the things that disturbs me the most about what I'm seeing in American politics right now is the huge infusion of cash and even more importantly, the personal cash of candidates now. You know, they're pricing those in the middle and lower classes from office, from being able to even run for office. Yep. And that's a real concern. So to see somebody at the vice presidential level who is living with relatively modest means is really refreshing.
He seems authentic. He seems real because of it. He speaks the language of the locals. His stories resonate. He has a positive message. Oh, what a change, right? I think people aren't so easily confused by all the attacks and negativity because they're finally seeing something that reminds them of themselves in positions of leadership, and they're thinking, well, maybe I do matter.
And he is the best zingers when he puts on that Minnesota accent, too. You can tell when they're coming.
Love that. All right, we're out of time. My thanks to everybody for being with us this morning, including our wonderful panel, Vera Karyos-Kelly, Bob Griffin, Sarah Rogerson. You all are wonderful. I thank you very much for being with us, and thank you for your contributions this morning and every morning. We will continue our program right after this short break.